Hi, everyone. My name is Natalie Gochner, and you are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. On the political left, I have with me Shireen Gorbani. Hi, Shireen.
Hello, and hey to the listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
And in the studio with us today, the state auditor, John Dougal, sitting in for Dan McKay. Hi, John.
Hey, always great to be with you.
Political right, left, and middle, and lots of things to talk about. We've got a Ketanji Brown Jackson who has advanced now. Let's get your quick take, Shireen.
I think this is incredible. I feel like after what was a bit of a circus when it came to some of the questions that she was asked during the initial confirmation hearings, it's incredible to see this move forward. And I am unbelievably proud of our Senator Mitt Romney for voting in support of Ketanji Brown Jackson. This is wonderful. And I want to encourage people to call his office if you think that was a good move, because I think he's taken a lot of heat.
John, you have Senators Romney, Murkowski, Collins all supporting the president's nomination. Would you have supported Ketanji Brown Jackson?
I'm not sure. I'm going to say probably not.
Okay.
But it's still one of those things. I mean, right now you look, and the whole advice and consent of the Senate when it comes to judicial nominations, it's a circus. It's been a circus for decades. When we look at Neil Gorsuch, he only had three Democrats back his confirmation process. Kavanaugh had one. Amy Coney Barrett had zero.
Yeah.
This is kind of, you know, we sit there and talk, you know, qualifications versus ideology. We're shifting hardcore into the ideology for judges, especially, I think, because it's the lifetime appointment. So what is their ideology on the bench? And I think there was a lack of understanding of exactly where Judge Jackson was from a Republican perspective. And so that clearly weighs in heavily in terms of that perspective. And I think we're going to keep seeing this for decades to come.
I would argue from the middle, John, that by supporting the nomination, you're getting out of the politicization of this and into the, you know, is this person qualified? And does the president indeed get to nominate their candidates and push it through? Anyway.
But how do you de-escalate? I mean, clearly both parties have amped it up, and then how do you back it down?
Yeah. So, John, you and I have a funny one. I could have this wrong, but I remember one time I mentioned that Romney keeps canceling Lee's vote, and you texted me. I said it on the show, and you texted me, how do you know it's Lee not canceling Romney's vote?
Just had to tease you a little bit.
Kind of, yeah,
fun. Well, what
stuff.
Do you think of it, Natalie?
Oh, I would have voted to confirm. Senator Romney continues to shine in my way of thinking, and it's because it's de-escalating a very divided Washington, a divided world, and I think she withheld the scrutiny. And sure, there's some things that, like, a Senator Lee's not going to agree on, but he's not the president,
right?
You know? And I don't think it was enough to say you're not eligible to do this.
Yeah, I think it's just kind of an amazing moment where I feel like Mitt Romney is again on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm. So we've got higher gas prices. Something that
just a little bit.
Yeah, a lot of people are watching.
So what are
closely.
They? Because Shireen and I drive electric vehicles. So
yeah,
what? No, just joking.
I'm having so much fun with you all driving your electric vehicles, thinking like you're doing something great, and it's like 65% of our electricity in the state comes from coal. Tell me about that.
I was in Price on Friday night, and they love it when I drive my electric car because, you know, it's coal powered.
Yeah.
So, but no, I was in the basin yesterday, and so I drove my gas powered. Car to get out there and back.
Yeah. Well, President Biden has ordered a release of 1 million barrels per day from the National Strategic Petroleum Reserve. Big use of a big release of the U.S. stockpile. I think it was the right thing to do. I'll say my thought first, Shireen.
Well, I continue to be really interested in the conversations that are happening around price gouging, right? Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that the actual cost of a barrel of oil is coming down, but we are not seeing that at the when you go to fill up your
mm-hmm.
tank.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also seeing these oil companies with record profits. And there has to be some space in there for movement, and we're just simply not seeing the kind of accountability that we need to see. And I think, frankly, that would be a good place to start.
John, do you agree that there's windfall profits here going to oil and gas companies?
Well, I'm going to point out Exxon last year had $23 billion in profits. That's in 2021. But if you look at 2020, it had $22.4 billion in losses.
Mm-hmm. This reminds me of the airlines industry.
This is really offsetting.
Yeah.
Massive losses, massive windfalls. And so it just goes back and forth. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've heard people talking about price gouging and other things like that. But when you actually look into it, when you look at all the factors, you look at, you know, not just the price of crude, you look at the cost of refinery, you look at the operating cost at the stations that dispense it, you look at, you know, supply versus demand, all those things get mixed together. And rarely is there price gouging that's going on.
At the Gardner Institute, we're going to have a newsmaker breakfast on high, you know, motor fuel prices. And so we've been looking into it a little bit. You know, when you adjust prices at the pump for inflation and for incomes, we're not in as bad of a situation as we were as recently as the Great Recession. I mean, sometimes we think that this is like just panic mode, and really the ebb and flow, the rise and fall of fuel prices is like, that's the norm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and you know, oil executives were testifying in front of Congress on Wednesday. And when you look at some of the testimony there, they're talking about labor shortages. They've looked at three downturns in 12 years, shortages for drilling rig equipment, other things like that, you know, fracking sand, steel pipes, and so forth, supply chain issues that all weigh into the cost of delivery. And people act like there's got to be just some surplus that's just sitting there that these companies can release. Mm-hmm. But if you're a for-profit company, you can't afford to just have excess capacity just sitting there in reserve.
Competition takes care of that.
Competition takes care of it, and you're producing.
Yeah. I also need to note, though, when we're thinking about the kinds of jobs that we're talking about in a labor shortage, these are often very incredibly dangerous jobs. I grew up in North Dakota, where we saw a huge boom on the Bakken, on the kind of Canada border. And it's a rough place to work, and it does require high skill, and it's often very, very dangerous. So people deserve to be paid if they're going to be brought into these, you know, kinds of jobs. And there's a lot of opportunity, I think, to improve the lives of individuals who are working in those jobs.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
I'll also note the Biden administration, you know, canceled the XL pipeline. You know, they've stopped issuing leases on federal public lands, stuff like that.
But there are also oil companies.
Massive uncertainty. And you've got investors who, you know, in the past are saying, hey, we took losses in all this type of stuff, fracking, other things like that. And there's an uncertainty with the administration. They don't really want to invest because they don't know if they're going to get a return on their investment.
But, John, there are many oil companies right now sitting on leases on public lands that they are not using, they have not used, and they are not in any way required to do that. But to say that the issue is that the Biden administration has canceled additional leases on these public lands totally ignores that they're sitting on opportunity that they are not using.
Well, what I said is they stopped issuing leases.
So they stopped
issuing
leases.
Not the canceling, but the stopped issuing. And so,
uncertainty
feeds into this dynamic, which is why would I invest if I'm not sure I'm going to get a return? I'm going to take a loss. I might as well just sit and put my money elsewhere.
John, let's stick with you for a second. The Biden administration has finalized fuel efficiency standards. They'll require new cars and light trucks to average 49 miles per gallon by 2026. This really caught my eye because I worked at the EPA. And I remember just a moment when I learned something. You know, it was like the third floor of the EPA building. They were talking about fuel efficiency standards, and there was security that precluded us from going up to the floor, because if you heard something in advance, you could leak it, pass it along, and it would affect the stock market. Just an interesting thought of how powerful these regulations are. But what do you make of these standards? These are really tough standards, and they come after a time when Trump rolled back fuel efficiency standards.
Well, the interesting dynamic from my perspective is, right now, if the price of gas is going to be high for an extended period of time, it will probably do more to drive fuel efficiency than any mandate from the federal government. Mm-hmm. And so on the one side, they're saying, okay, we're going to increase the fuel efficiency requirements. At the same time, they're clamoring to reduce the price of gas. And so it's a conflicting message from my perspective.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, when we drive all this technology for greater fuel efficiency, to a certain extent, it makes the cars more expensive, and all of a sudden starts hitting low-income folks and middle-income folks with higher-priced vehicles, and that goes not just the cost of the vehicle, but cost of insurance and everything else that feeds into it.
They keep their old car longer,
which
is more polluting. Shireen, what did you make of these? I mean, I'm assuming you're a fan of them, but
I am. I'm also a fan of what's happening in industry. I think this is an example where we're seeing industry leaders coming out and saying we're, you know, increasing electric fleet, we are increasing fuel efficiency, and they're doing that because a broader market demands it, right? And that's nice to see. I think it's good to see these back in place, but I also think probably this is a case where the industry element will move faster than government will in terms of addressing these kinds of regulations.
Mm-hmm. Shireen, did you see that President Obama made his first visit back to the White House, I think, since he left?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, a reunion with President Biden. It was to really talk about, you know, mark the 12-year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act. You think that there's some public relations value to this?
I do. I'm grateful for the Affordable Care Act. Please do not in any way get me wrong on that. I'm grateful for any steps that are taken to expand access to healthcare in this country. I would note, though, that we still have millions of Americans. I think it's over 30 million Americans who do not have access to health care. So there's still a long way to go there. But yeah, I do think it was, an opportunity to maybe bring a little excitement back to the White House. Biden is certainly having a tough time. And, I think it's probably cool to hang out with President Obama.
With Joe. John.
Joe and Barack out playing basketball.
What did you think of this? I mean, in the final analysis, the Affordable Care Act was so controversial. You know, went to the Supreme Court, withheld by the Supreme Court, rippled through economy. Some of it has gone into place. Not all of it has. But in the end, I mean, it's been okay, hasn't it?
Well, has it destroyed healthcare? No. Has it fixed it? No. Healthcare is still a disaster. It's still broken. It's still too expensive.
Yeah.
Just because it's subsidized by taxpayers didn't mean it's any cheaper. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of regulations that go into it. We're seeing more and more consolidation of healthcare providers, which I think is driven by regulatory aspects. The cost of compliance is forcing consolidation, and all that stuff I don't think is good for healthcare, and it's not fixing it.
Yeah.
It's still just as dysfunctional or
still
more.
Still very broken. I tell people that everybody has a bad story about healthcare.
Yeah.
In this country. Just my thought. Hey, in our next segment, we're going to talk about Senator Lee has challengers. They're on the primary ballot. Let's talk through that in the second segment. I'm Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned, everybody.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shireen Gorbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. I mentioned that we're going to talk about Senator Mike Lee facing two primary challengers for a three-way race. Thus far, big news to me. Two outstanding women qualify with signatures, I guess, to be on the ballot.
Becky Edwards and Allie Isom.
Put names to them. Yeah, and Allie Isom. I guess the first crazy thing is, why haven't they combined forces? Let's get both of your reaction to that one.
Oh, I don't hang out with Republicans. You tell me.
John, what do you think there?
I'm not sure, but, I've been on the county convention circuit for the last few weeks, and clearly there's a lot of commonality in their message. Mm-hmm. And, so when you get into a primary, they're going to split the vote.
Mm-hmm. So this is the big sort of strategic and tactical kind of thing. It's like, what's going on here? I will just say, I know both of these women. I know Allie better than I do Becky. They're both phenomenal. Think very highly of them. Allie, I know better, and I'm a huge Allie Isom fan. But the real story in this race, I think, is not the Republican primary. It's the final with Evan McMullen.
Mm.
You got an independent there. So if Becky or Allie would have come to me and said—
Is this where I say yawn?
Okay. You can't.
Well, his previous campaign for presidency, I think, was a loser, and there's nothing there that excites me at all. There's nothing that's interesting.
Yeah.
I'm just like,
I think as a rule, he's very uninteresting to the Republican political class. But I think to the non-political class moderates, he might have some appeal.
I think that's right. Well, and I also think it's important to distinguish that a presidential race is different, right? It really is. And when you think about the message that you're trying to convey and what you're trying to do in that environment versus here, I think there are some really critical differences. And also, what Evan McMullen brings to the table is a huge opportunity for mm-hmm. people who are anti-Trump, as we're seeing many strains of different politicians at different levels on the right kind of going further into Trump territory, using the same kind of talking points, trying to use the same kind of, I think, attitude and style. Mm-hmm. And Evan is absolutely not that. Certainly Becky and Allie are not as well. But to see Trump come out and basically give the highest praise to Mike Lee is not good. I don't think that should be a good sign to anybody. That is a person who tried to overturn an election. Yeah. So we're clear. I think this is all interesting. And I think that we're in a space now where we're going to see again, we have an opportunity to see when engaged voters really have the opportunity to go. And I think very strategic voters, where they're going to put their power. And this could be an interesting race.
Well, the part that I love is watching the Democrats. They're sitting there in this race mm-hmm. saying, go register as a Republican to vote in the Republican primary. Mm-hmm. Don't nominate a Democratic candidate in this race. Back this independent
guy. Super interesting.
It's like they've already conceded that the party means nothing. The Democratic Party means nothing in Utah. Mm-hmm. This is what's comical to me.
I think you also have to understand, though, there are many Democrats within the party who are absolutely not giving that message. And I think it's important for people to understand that there is a subset of people who have diehard Democrats in the state who absolutely think that that is not the right thing to do, that that is a terrible idea. So to say the Democrats are saying it is really missing a very important voice inside of the party. And I don't expect you to know that because you probably don't spend your time hanging at our hangouts and conventions. But there is...
She just invited me to come.
Average, you can come. We have a great time. The average voter, I think, is the one who is out there, not people who are showing up at caucuses, not people who are showing up at conventions, but the average voter is the person who is flipping their, you know, they had their Huntsman signs and they took those down and they put up their Chris Peterson signs. They're the people who have their Becky signs out now. We'll see what they do in a couple months.
So I want to go back to Donald Trump endorsing Mike Lee just for a minute. That raised a conversation in my family around the dinner table. I guess Donald Trump called Mike Lee top of the line, you know, and this kind of thing. I found myself saying to my family, you know, character really matters to me. And if you talk to a Mike Lee, I think, but if you talk to a lot of people in this state that look the other way with Donald Trump, they say, oh, I don't really like his character, but I love his policies, or I like his policies. And so I'm going to go with the policies I agree on. And the point I made to my kids that I want to say on both sides of the aisle is that you can have both. You can have the policies you want and character that you want if you align yourself with those types of people. And by giving Donald Trump a pass on his character, I think we mess it up. So I'm looking mostly at you, John, but I know that I believe this is what Ali Isom and Becky Edwards represent, is the part of the Republican Party that says enough. We don't want this bad character stuff.
Well, and I'm not sure Mike Lee was going out asking to get Trump's endorsement versus Trump wanting credibility with Mike Lee of offering his endorsement. I'll note that Romney also got endorsed by Donald Trump as well. So it's an interesting
crazy
dynamic.
I don't even remember that.
But words have changed now, though.
Well,
I mean, sentiment has changed.
If I'm Mike Lee, I want to be able to say, you know, I am a conservative choice, and I call all this stuff that's been going on in the Republican Party what it is. It's wrong.
And I'm going to say Mike Lee has been a much more thoughtful person than what you're describing as Donald Trump. So
Fair enough. Okay, we got a new poll out. This is a Deseret News Hinckley Institute of Politics poll. They asked people about who has the most influence in Utah.
I think it was other than the state auditor. Who has?
Because they knew it would have been auditor all the way.
Just joking.
So the choices were legislative leaders, you know, the governor, city and county leaders. Interestingly, the legislative leaders and the governor basically tied. I'm thinking if I looked at the margin of errors, about a third and a third said that they were both the most powerful.
Right.
How did you react to that, John?
Well, I think this is one of those things of largely, I think probably the poll is probably missed it a little bit. I mean, I think in general, if you look over the last several decades, you'd probably say the legislative leadership on average has been more powerful than the governor. Now, governors have the bully pulpit. They're one person, they can speak clearly, and so when they really get behind an issue, they can really drive that issue and have a lot of impact on that issue. But, you know, when they're scattered on a whole bunch of different dynamics, then just the heft of the legislative power of 104 people working together can really move things along.
Well, so just one follow-up. Do you think it's in our state's interest to have a strong governor or a weaker governor?
I think it depends on what the issues are.
Shereen, I thought he'd say, well, it depends on the governor. It depends on the issue. But in as a general form of government, you know, because I'm of the opinion and I'm in the political middle, and we have a long history of very good governors who are moderates, very moderate. And so I like, you know, the executive branch. I like the governors. You can challenge me on it. But I think that's the person that everyone votes for. That's the person that everyone, you know, can name. You know, it's the person that has the biggest bully pulpit, so you know what they think and believe. And I think they're the natural leader. And they have all the tools to lead the state in terms of the state's workforce, the state's assets. So I think the legislature is super important, but I don't like them being more powerful than the CEO.
Well, I think the dynamic is what I really want from the governor is somebody who's putting a check on what the legislature does. So I get really concerned when governors start running off. That's a weak governor model. Well, I'm not going to say that's weak governor model. Weak governor model is they don't even veto. They just let the legislature do whatever they want.
Well, I was just going to say that you want the legislature to be a check on the governor. That would be a strong model.
Okay. And so to me, since the legislature is going to push so much, you know, I want to look for a governor who's going to put checks on the legislature and what they do and those type of things. And so when you run the risk of a governor, a single executive, acting on certain areas which may be trampling on people's rights or other areas of concern, it's hard for the legislature to be a check.
Yeah.
It's easier the other way around.
Shereen, arguably it's a partnership, and I get that. But the interesting thing that I'm kind of noticing is that the legislature's part-time.
Yeah.
By design, a part-time legislature. And so it throws me off to think of them as being overly strong in terms of running the state, because we're supposed to have this citizen legislature that's, you know, representing everyday people, bringing all those great perspectives. But the full-time chief executive who guides, leads the state is the governor.
Yeah. So I would be more in alignment with kind of your read on this, Natalie. And I do think that our legislature is, a bit out of control. But I think what the interesting thing here is the question was, you know, who has the most influence in Utah? And when you think about your day-to-day life, it is startling to me how often people are very confused about who is making decisions that most frequently touch their lives. And I think about this when I was running for Congress, standing on people's doors, doorsteps. I remember really distinctly, I can name the intersection in Rose Park. And this person was like, there needs to be a stop sign here. And I was like, oh, I'm running for Congress.
Interesting.
But
yeah.
The issues that impact
people. But could
people,
you take care of the stop sign?
Could you do
yeah,
it?
There's
could,
a
probably
pothole.
Could now. Could
yeah.
make a
when
now.
I was in the legislature, they wanted me to deal with certain teachers.
Yeah.
Wanted them fired. It's like, I don't hire
it doesn't
the teachers.
Work that way.
Yeah, interesting.
But
well,
I do think people are disconnected from the way that their local government, like at the county or
fair.
Municipal level, is really impacting how their life operates here.
Yeah.
And I agree that we have many important decisions made at the legislature, and I do think the balance is out of whack. But I would love if people got more into municipal government.
Well, and the other thing I'd say, we have a strong legislature right now, and they're doing amazing things. What they did on Great Salt Lake, I'm a huge fan, and what they've done for recreational trails, what they're doing for other water things. Anyway.
Mental well-being, a ton of great work this
year. And that's a credit to our speaker and to our president. So a lot of this is personality. Like when you have the right personalities, just have whoever's, you know, the most well-guided be in charge. But all things being equal, I like a strong executive
branch.
And
some of these polls are also to try and pick fights between, you know, legislators and the governor and stuff like that, because it sells papers.
I think it also helps to understand, though, I do think people look at the world this way.
Yeah.
I do.
You mentioned you wanted to talk about UDOT's delaying of the Little Cottonwood traffic solution.
I'm just kind of curious what your thoughts are on this and stuff like that.
Are you a bus
so this
or a
is
gondola?
The gondola bus, you know, do nothing thing. We obviously have a problem.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, you tell me. I asked you. What do you think? Bus, gondola?
Well, I don't live there. I don't go up the canyon that often. I'm surprised at the number of people that seem to be opposed to the gondola, because I would have thought that would have probably been the more popular of the choices.
Yeah.
And so I'm a little surprised at the pushback at that.
I'm anti-gondola.
So I serve on the Transportation Commission. I'm a gubernatorial appointee in that role. We do not have jurisdiction over this, so I don't really have a conflict, whatever. I think, you know, that UDOT's basically following all the environmental rules that they need to do this. It seems to me, though, that the gondola will not prevail from everything I'm seeing. And I think there's a few reasons for that, but it's so expensive. Both are expensive, but it's so expensive.
By expensive, we're talking $500 million or more.
Yeah. And is it clear that it solves the problem? Because you still have to get people to the launching point, you know, and so there's still traffic on the roads to that launching point. And so you have to take them from somewhere else. So you bus them to the gondola. Are people going to do a two-stop thing, you know, where you drop your car off here, bus, get the gondola thing, then go up?
No.
Yeah, Shereen's kind of shaking her head.
Every transfer point's a friction point.
That's
it
right.
It makes it inconvenient.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the last thing, I'm kind of doing these out of order, but we have seen the Davis County convention where there was a definite run to the right. Robert Gerke, Brian Schott in the Republican convention. Let's get Dougal's quick comments on that.
Well, what I'm seeing as I'm traveling the state is there's a lot of folks that are agitated because of COVID. They're agitated because of the transgender sports bill. They're agitated on a few other things. And so they've really mobilized and they're out there engaged in the political process.
Yeah.
And that's what I'm seeing.
Shereen?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think it's concerning. I think some of the talking points that we're hearing from these candidates are concerning. And I think when we think about the power that our legislature has, the people that are in those seats, what they say and what they think really does matter. And I'll just add that this last week I spent some time volunteering for Project Rainbow, which puts up the pride flags during, you know, Pride Month, and put up trans flags this last week for Transgender Day of Visibility. And in this year, they said that they had more defaced and stolen than they have ever experienced before. I think what is happening and the discourse that's happening in our state is concerning, and there are very real impacts to that we're seeing play out across our community. So seeing individuals that are further right or more extreme or frankly, quite bigoted on some of these issues, I think is not a good look for our state. And I think it's harmful to the individuals who live here.
Yeah. Did it surprise you, John, just to see, I mean, someone like Representative Steve Handy that didn't get nominated again?
Well, they say in politics, friends come and go, enemies accumulate. Uh-huh. And so the longer you're there, the greater the chance that you're going
to
lose
Happened
your election.
Happened to Lyle and, up in
Hilliard a few years ago and other things like that. It's just the longer you're there, the more likely you're going to lose an election.
Yeah. Well, a lot to still come from that. But in general, like Shireen, you see it as a bad sign. Do you see it as a bad sign?
Well, I see it as good that people are getting out there, getting engaged. Sometimes, you know, they're engaged and they're going to learn as they go through the process because they had certain views that as they start learning more, it's like, okay, it's not quite that way. So getting them engaged, I think, is good.
We're going to have to make that a wrap. Natalie Gochner, representing the political middle, John Dougal on the right, Shireen Gourbani on the left. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Hey, thanks, everybody, for listening.